Hi, this is Bill Ringel, host of My Quest for the Best, where we meet business, thought, and community leaders to discuss issues relevant to entrepreneurial growth. Joining us today is Elaine Popel. Elaine is an independent journalist who specializes in writing about careers and entrepreneurship. She has been a senior editor at Fortune Small Business Magazine and writes for Money, Inc., Forbes, and a variety of other print and online publications. She's a contributing editor and columnist at Crain's New York Business. At Fortune, she writes a column called David versus Goliath, looking at companies that are taking on giant competitors. She also founded Fortune Small Business's National Business Plan Competition and ran it for 5 years. Welcome, Elaine.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be here.
Elaine, tell me, how did you get started as a journalist?
I'm one of those lucky people who knew what they wanted to do. Probably back in kindergarten, I always wanted to be a writer, and I was the kid who was on the high school newspaper. I was the editor of my paper at Floral Park Memorial High School on Long Island, and when I went to college, I was the arts and entertainment editor of the Yale Daily News. I segued into my career by getting internships at the Los Angeles Times and the Hartford Courant. This was back in the days when newspapers were where every young journalist wanted to work. And then over time, I transitioned from being a newspaper reporter to an editor, and then eventually to a magazine editor at Fortune Small Business Magazine at Time, Inc. I worked there for 8 years, and then in 2007, I went independent, and I've been an independent writer and editor ever since.
What was that decision like to go independent in 2007? You know, looking back, that was a difficult time in the economy. Was there a big opportunity, or were there other things driving that decision?
There were a number of factors for me. After being at one publication for a long time, sometimes it's very exciting to get out and be able to explore other topics that really don't fall under the mission of that publication. So I think that there were some untapped projects within me that I wanted to pursue. I have four children who are between the ages of 2 and 9 now. At the time, I had three young children, and I was telecommuting to work, and I felt like I would like to have a little more freedom in my schedule to spend time with them and also do the work that I loved. And so that was a factor also. It was a little scary. My husband is also a freelancer, and we didn't have much of a safety net, but I was really committed to making it work, and I had freelanced at one other point in my career for a short time, so I knew I could do it. I had contacts in the industry. I've been a journalist for more than 20 years, so I just took a leap. And while it wasn't always easy, especially the first 2 years, it worked out well 5 years later.
As you think about making that transition, what are some of the things that you needed to do differently than you expected in order to get the kind of business that you wanted?
I think when a lot of people start out as freelancers, and I was no exception, you think, okay, finally, I'm not going to do any of the projects I don't want to do. I'm only going to do the ones that are creatively fulfilling, exciting, taking my career to the next level. What I learned over time is that sometimes those projects can be few and far between. You've got to persuade clients to hire you to do them. It may not fit the mission of particular publications, in my case, that you would like to write for. So you need to strike a balance in your business and find a mix of work that pays the bills and also allows you to be creatively fulfilled. And that mix can change from year to year. So the first year I tried to make my living entirely by journalism articles. And that's hard because sometimes, you know, they take a while to come to fruition. They might be sitting on an editor's desk for 6 months, and that can impact your cash flow, which when you have a family is a real consideration. So I learned over time to include a mix of other types of projects. It could be consulting. I had run Fortune Small Business Online for 4 years during my period at Time, Inc., and I have a lot of experience running a fairly substantial size website. So I wove some editorial consulting into the mix, and I also started taking on retainer clients, which makes a difference. It gave me a little bit more income stability so that when I wanted to pursue my dream articles, I had the bandwidth to do it, and I wasn't worried also about paying my health insurance and my mortgage.
So tell me, what is it like to set up a retainer client? How does that work as a journalist?
It doesn't happen overnight. Typically, for me, and this may be different for others, I don't know how people always do it, but in my case, it just evolved naturally. I had some clients that used me repeatedly, and we had a great relationship. It just felt like it was a really good fit. And so at a certain point, they both approached me and said, hey, would you like to have a contract and work for us on a more regular basis? And that was what happened. It happened around the same time, actually, with both of my main retainer clients. And so that has really helped a lot. It's also nice because when you work with a client over and over again, it's kind of like being on staff in that you know them well, you know what they want. There are things that don't have to be said every time the way they do if you're taking on a new client. You know their requirements, you know their little internal unspoken rules, and it just makes it easier and I think more fun for everybody. So that's one recommendation I would have, is if you have certain clients that are just really great to work with on many different levels, that you put those relationships first in your business and cultivate things so that you do build some sort of an ongoing relationship instead of one-off projects. That's what really helped me to take my business to the next level.
Let's look at it both ways. From your perspective, what do you think are some of the things that you did in order to build those great relationships? And then from the publication's perspective, what are some of the things that they looked for in order to select you to offer a contract?
Well, I think they're both the same thing in a way. I was an assigning editor for many years on staff at Fortune Small Business, and in previous work I did also. So I knew what I wanted in freelancers and what other editors wanted, and I tried to be that freelancer that I wanted to hire. And what that means really is it's not about you, it's about them. A lot of writers, I think we're creative people and we have our creative vision. The client doesn't really care. They have their own vision, and when they're bringing you in, it's really to make their life easier and to help them advance that vision. They're very collaborative often, and they want your input, but they don't want prima donnas. They want someone who, once you agree on what the project is, you deliver it, it's to the highest standards, it's on time, it's fact-checked, and basically it doesn't cause them any problems. They also like to work with people who are empathetic to them and the situation that they're in. Right now it's a very tough time to be an editor, and most of the publications out there are pretty short-staffed. So the editor doesn't always have time, for instance, if they need a photo from a source to request it. They're constantly overloaded with work. So if you're a freelancer who doesn't mind sending an email to the source and asking them to send in a photo, little gestures like that can go a long way. So I try to be that freelancer, and I think that that's in the case of the retainer clients, and even in the clients where I don't have a retainer arrangement but I have an ongoing relationship, I think that's what they were looking for, and that's why they wanted to work with me on a continuing basis.
As you think about your business, and you've been in business now for 5 or coming up on 6 years, I guess, you said the first 2 years were different and challenging. What were one of the points where you said, oh, now I've got this figured out? Was it when you got your first retainer client? Was it when you got a significantly larger contract than you had been? What was the point where you look back and say that was a turning point?
Well, I think about 2 years into it, it was when I started doing retainer work. I also started evaluating projects differently. In the beginning, I was just establishing myself, and even though I was a pretty well-established journalist, I wasn't established as a freelance writer, and people didn't really know I was even available to do freelance, so I felt like a little bit of an unknown. And so I was always so happy to get every assignment that I didn't really think about, does this work for me? You know, how am I going to feel about the end product? Do I like the editing process at a given publication? I was just so eager to please that I think I took on projects that really were unprofitable for me, and in the end, I don't know that they really advanced my journalistic goals either. They were good projects, but they weren't really what I was most passionate about. I was maybe excited to get an article in a really big publication, and so I started to evaluate projects more objectively and look at, do they fit my mission as a journalist? And I realized that that mission wasn't to be a generalist. I was kind of marketing myself as a generalist. I really had expertise in small business and careers and entrepreneurship, and I could really offer a lot more depth when I wrote about those than if, for instance, I wrote about parenting, which is an interesting subject to me, and I am a parent, but I'm really not a parenting journalist, and I really couldn't move the conversation forward in the same way just based on my own experience and someone who's been reporting on that for years and years. So I kind of focused and specialized, which helped a lot. And then just focusing more on the ongoing relationships, realizing that there were some relationships where I was putting a lot of time and effort into keeping the clients happy, but they really had very little work for me over the course of a year. And while I would always try to keep any client as happy as possible, it made sense to invest my time and efforts and emotional energy more in the clients that wanted to work with me and had the bandwidth to work with me over and over again over a long period of time. I mean, I think that was another turning point, is realizing I don't want short-term relationships. I really am in this for long-term relationships. I like getting to know my clients, having a depth to the whole relationship, and so focusing on that helped me a lot as well.
So it's the depth, the relationships, and the potential for ongoing work that really made the difference. So you started looking at this more in terms of activity, where you could stay busy with writing, to looking at more as a business, where you're staying focused on your mission and being able to develop the long-term relationships that are mutually beneficial.
Well, it was both. In a way, making that decision to focus more on the business actually helped me more with my writing too, because I really was most interested in writing about entrepreneurship. This always really excited me, and I love interviewing entrepreneurs and knowing about how they run their businesses. So when I focus more on, you know, finding my niche, focusing on the right types of clients, it actually helped me to do better journalism, because we were focused on the same thing. You know, for instance, I started writing the column for Fortune, and I love working on it. It's the perfect assignment for me. It's an ongoing relationship, but I'm not doing it just because it provides recurring revenue, although that's nice. It really fits my mission as an entrepreneur, myself, and as somebody who likes to write about entrepreneurship, because I get to really explore small businesses that are up against big competitors. It's called David versus Goliath. And, you know, I'm very interested in all their strategies. And so it's just a perfect fit on a lot of different levels. And I think for most people, that's where you're at a good place, where your business mission and your personal creative mission intersect.
Yeah, there's that alignment with your mission and their mission. Tell me more about the David versus Goliath column. It's a passion of yours, and it's of great interest to people who can see smaller businesses taking on the competition from larger businesses.
Well, I've been writing it for a couple of years now, and basically I look for businesses that are changing their industries. They're usually at the stage where the original entrepreneur is still very much a key player, and they're somehow managing to survive in a niche where they're really up against a giant company, but somehow by specializing, by offering better customer service, by offering something different, they manage to survive and grow, and they keep the big Goliath on their toes. I love these stories, because there's a lot of courage required to be an entrepreneur, and these entrepreneurs are always very courageous. It's not easy to step into a market where there's a really big, well-financed opponent, I guess you might say, but they somehow managed to do it. And I think we can all learn from this, because a lot of small businesses really do shake up their industries. They become mid-size and big companies eventually, and they're worth paying attention to. And that's what I like about this column. I can look for the companies that really are doing something that we all should be following, because it's going to change the workplace or some key marketplaces.
Dylan, can you tell me a little bit about one of the Davids you've written about and the specifics of how they took on Goliath in their industry?
Well, one interesting company, Beverly Feldman, is a shoe manufacturer, and her Goliath, I guess you might say, is Stuart Weitzman. And She founded her business in 1979, and her strategy is really relevant today. She diversified into overseas markets early, and when sales slowed in the U.S. during the recession, she was already well represented in Asia, and so that's been a really good ongoing strategy. She makes appearances on HSN in order to promote the brand. She's a very fun person, and she has made it her selling point that her shoes don't hurt. They're very stylish, but any woman who has worn dress shoes knows they don't always feel that great. So I thought she was a lot of fun. I mean, she was really a forerunner. There weren't a lot of women entrepreneurs running multi-million dollar businesses at that point. She, at the point I had written about her, was projecting sales of $9.5 million. And they were up from the year before at $8 million in 2009. So I think she would be a good example. We have people in all different industries. They're not all manufacturers, but I thought she was really prescient in figuring out a global strategy. And now we see everything is global. But at that time, I don't think that many manufacturers were quite as global as she was in terms of getting her product out.
And when you spoke with her, what was it that you saw that enabled her to make this transition and take on a risky strategy by going overseas when it wasn't popular to go overseas?
She struck me as a very bold person, and she seemed like she was willing to try things. And so I think that's what really leapt out at me. She wasn't waiting for someone else to do it first. She thought this made sense. She's a global citizen. You know, she traveled widely, and so she just knew that this made sense, and she trusted her gut instinct. Of course, I'm sure she did a lot of research, but it was that. She wasn't waiting for someone else to go do it first.
That makes sense. Plus, being able to hone in on, you know, offering shoes that are stylish without the pain, I think is a great differentiator.
I think so, too, and it wasn't really the case back then. I think now, you know, the women's movement has really shaped the way things are marketed, and so women feel more empowered to say those shoes don't hurt, you know, that my shoes shouldn't hurt, rather. But I don't think at the time she was starting out it was quite that way. I mean, she started it in 1979, and the women's movement was starting, but it hadn't had the results it's had now. So I think that was another thing. She was one of the first to really make that a marketing message. And now she has cooperative advertising with some of her retail partners. She sells the shoes in stores like Nordstrom and Lord & Taylor. They're about $200 a pair. And so they're obviously receptive to her message, and I think that also shows her market leadership. I mean, now there are so many companies that offer stylish, comfortable shoes for women, but it was really a fresh message when she started out.
And what do you see this company doing that others can learn from in terms of their leadership and their vision?
I think that she, as an entrepreneur, trusted her own observations. She knew that she didn't like wearing uncomfortable shoes, and yet she liked being stylish. And she just trusted her vision that there were other people out there who felt the same way. And I think that I've interviewed so many hundreds of entrepreneurs over the years, and it really comes down to that. An entrepreneur who's successful will usually spot an opportunity in the market that's not being tapped, and at a certain point take a leap of faith that they're correct, that other people also want what they want. And, you know, in her case, it was these shoes. It could be anything. It could be a tech product. It could be, you know, a certain type of retail store. It doesn't really matter, but they trusted their own observations. Usually they do a lot of market research informally or formally to back up the fact that there really is a business there. I think that's really important. But then at a certain point, they really kind of put their money where their mouth is, and they try getting the product out there and seeing if people will buy it. And that's really the bottom line. They don't wait around for the perfect moment where everything is proved to them that this is going to work. They will test market it and see what happens. And in her case, it worked out very well.
Elaine, because you are in touch with so many different successful entrepreneurs sharing so many different viewpoints. What would you say, based on your own observations, is one of the prevailing myths that are out there that you'd like to address?
Well, the biggest one I'd like to address is the fact that being an entrepreneur is risky. It is a little bit risky. It's not a myth entirely, but I think it's much more risky today to have a corporate job. If you look at all the trends right now in the economy, a lot of jobs are going away, and I think that we're at a point now where what we think of as a traditional job will be gone. It's becoming a relic, the job with, you know, the gold-plated benefits, the job with security. There's no security in corporate jobs. They're really set up for people who can devote their time 24/7 to hanging on to that job and really have no outside responsibilities and don't go above a certain salary level. As soon as that changes, they're no longer profitable for the company. You see how the corporations are sitting on profits. And they get discarded and pushed out. And so you're basically living, when you have a corporate job, as someone who's disposable. Unless you have a very sought-after skill, like you're an engineer at Google, that type of thing, I think that it's very risky to stake your whole career on that type of a lifestyle, because it's just going away. It was a very short period where that really was the reality. And I think young people realize this when I talk with them about their careers. They don't really anticipate staying with one company for 20 years the way earlier generations did. They know they're going to have to jump around. But we all, I think, need to be more entrepreneurial. And I think that for a lot of people, being an entrepreneur is less risky. And I think we've kind of lost touch with this. I think the United States was really founded in a way by entrepreneurs. No one came here. In every family, there was an immigrant at some point. Those people didn't always come here with a job in a corporation lined up for them. A lot of times the first step was entrepreneurship. And we've kind of lost the sense that we can do that. Everyone thinks, oh, it's too risky. X percent of businesses fail. I can't do this. But people did in the past. I think, got so comfortable with these paternalistic companies controlling our lives that people lost the sense that this is something you can really do. Fortunately, I think a lot of younger people, that you have the whole artisanal manufacturing movement, you see a lot of people going back to starting businesses now. You also see people by necessity who have been laid off in corporate America who are seeing that this can be an opportunity for them. But I think it's funny, because people who are still in that corporate world look at that as risky, and I think they're really the ones who are at risk of obsolescence. So I guess that's my long answer to your question.
I think those are terrific insights. If you were to speak to people who are in corporate jobs, what would be one or two skill sets that you would encourage them to develop so that it increases their range of opportunities, it increases their range of options, whether they wanted to stay in corporate or become an entrepreneur?
Well, I think one of the number one things everyone should be doing is realizing that you should not network only within your own company. Because companies are so fluid now, you really need to be networking outside of your company, keeping in touch with people who have left, becoming part of organizations that have nothing to do with it, including those outside of your industry that might have some overlap. Because what inevitably happens in these companies is the big manager who makes the high salary becomes too expensive and they get laid off, and like all that effort you've put into cultivating the relationship with your boss has to be restarted with someone else. Meanwhile, they may have no loyalty to you and may not keep you on. So what happens then? If you've kept your network strong outside of the company, you'll have a lot of different avenues to pursue, whether you want to get another job somewhere else with someone who you once worked with, or if you decide to start a business and maybe they can be a potential client. I think that's really important. The other thing is not to get sucked into this sense that you can't do anything outside of the company. I mean, it's very possible, even if you never want to leave, to have a little side business where you do something else. Maybe it's some consulting on the side. I mean, there might be some rules within the company you have to check on. But a lot of times people have passions that have nothing to do with their job. There's nothing stopping you from starting an entirely different type of business on the side so that you have a little bit of income coming in if something goes south with your job. And I think everybody needs to realize that you shouldn't be giving every ounce of your strength to your company, because you're more than what they define you as. You really have to define your own career today and be very resilient. I think the other thing is we're going to much more of a contingent workforce, so I think you need to kind of look at how your company is hiring contingent workers, temps, contractors, consultants, because more companies are going that way. And if you do get laid off, that might be a way to continue working with your company. I've seen that many times where people get laid off and then they come back in as a contractor or consultant, and that can be very lucrative. And it can be a way, if you like the people that you work with, to continue working with them. So those are my pieces of advice for corporate folks. I didn't mean, by the way, to put down anybody in corporate America. I just think that America needs a wake-up call on this. I think people, they don't want to face the fact that a lot of the jobs that we have valued and gone after are really going away and they will never come back. And I think we need to be prepared for it instead of being victims of it and just being cast aside in the economy.
I think that's a really strong message that needs to be heard. And I think your observations are right on point. Tell me this, Elaine. As a writer, you're also very much aware of what's going on. What do you read on a daily basis or weekly basis in order to stay informed?
Well, I always like to read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I think that they really offer great insights and, you know, great quality reporting, even in the challenged media environment that we're in. I think they still do a really good job. I of course, read the publications that I write for, like Fortune. I'm a blogger for Forbes, and I love the blogs on Forbes. I find them really interesting. And I find out that a lot of interesting career trends there that I think are just starting to bubble to the surface because they have so many different voices, and some of them are not professional journalists, that, you know, which adds a lot of interesting ideas to the mix. I'm the small business editor for Crain's New York Business, and New York is so central to a lot of the stuff that I do. It's a media capital, so I always read that very thoroughly. But I read all kinds of things. There's a magazine I love called The Sun. It's personal essays, and I just, you know, I love literary journalism, and I've been really into that publication lately. I'm always looking for, you know, interesting stimulation from all different sides.
That doesn't surprise me. Elaine, tell me, you're involved in lots of projects. You have lots of assignments coming in. You're always cultivating new work. What are one or two things that you've found, maybe techniques that you've developed or adopted, that help you stay on track and stay productive?
Well, one technique I use is really simple. I wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I set aside the time from 5 till about 7:30 to do my writing before anyone in my family is up, and before the phone starts ringing or emails start coming in. And I found that's my number one strategy for being productive, because I know at the end of the week, I always have 10 or 15 hours where I've just been giving my writing my all. And it's amazing how productive you can be without a lot of distractions. I don't let myself check email most of the time. Sometimes I backslide during that period. And then I set aside phone time in the mornings so that people know that that's when they can reach me. I try not to take unplanned phone calls. I schedule almost all of my calls, except certain clients have very time-sensitive needs. Of course, I'll pick up the phone, but I don't like to get derailed from my schedule because otherwise I just won't be as productive. The other thing is, this is something that I kind of learned over time. Putting a lot of effort in on the front end with clients is really important. You know, when you take on a new client, it's always nice if they will turn into a recurring client. So I always try to give everybody the same A-list service, the best possible effort that I can. And sometimes they're paying me more and sometimes less, but I never look at it that way. I just always assume that this client needs the same high level of service as any client does. And I think that feeds a lot of recurring work. I mean, one thing people should realize is that a lot of times people move around. So the person who is a young editor just starting out in their career at a certain publication, 10 years from now could be the editor of somewhere that you would like to write. And if you were paid less by them, or you know they were just a beginner, and you gave them lower service, or 10 years from now and you send them an email, are they going to want to hire you? know, you know, but I think a lot of people forget that. I hire freelancers for one of the assignments that I do, and sometimes I feel like they really scale their service based on what the pay rate is, and I think that's a really big mistake. And the ones who do that tend to be the ones who are always desperate for work, and the ones who, no matter what, always have blue chip service, always have enough work, and they're always overbooked, or you've got to get on their calendar a month from now. So I think that's really, really important, and people don't understand that. It's funny because years ago, I was at a publication that went bankrupt, and this is the first period where I freelanced for about 4 months, and I got an assignment for $150 to write this little article for the Fortune Small Business website. And, you know, it was 1999, $150 didn't go that far back then, but I figured, you know what, let me just give it my all. I don't know anybody at Timing, so it will be a good contact. And I did, and then the editor left, and her boss contacted me and said, do you know anybody who would be interested in running this website? The only contact I had with the whole organization was this little article that I did. And I said, yeah, I'd love to come in for an interview. And I did, and they hired me. And it was at a point where with the web, you didn't have to be an expert to run a website. Nobody was an expert. And so that was how I got the job at Fortune Small Business Online. And then that later led to a position at the magazine. But if I had treated that article differently, the way that a lot of freelancers do sometimes when the pay is a little lower, the result would never have been the same. And so I always think about that, how that opened the door to so many things, just prioritizing that article in the way that I did. You know, the payoff was just huge. And so I think any job that you get, whether it's a small client, a big client, you have to always treat it as potentially a really big opportunity and give it the treatment that you would if you knew that a lot was at stake. And it's amazing what the payoff can be.
Elaine Kofeld, you shared such great ideas with me today on my quest for the best. You've talked about how to form great relationships with the people who are hiring you. You've talked about the courage of entrepreneurs in order to step out both through your columns as well as the illustrations throughout your entire career, taking courage and making those decisions and believing in yourself. For sharing these ideas and so much more during this interview, I want to thank you for joining me today on my quest for the best.
Thank you, Bill. It's been my pleasure.